Good evening and welcome. I'm Amna Nawaz. Jeff Bennett is away. On the NewsHour tonight, President Biden and Prime Minister Trudeau announce an immigration deal to address the growing number of asylum seekers entering Canada from the United States. House Republicans push a controversial bill that would give parents more control over school curricula. And a shortage of an asthma medication is expected to worsen after one of only two U.S. manufacturers shuts down.
We really need additional manufacturers to step up and start adding this to their portfolio so that we're not reliant on a single source for the medication that we need for our patients.
Good evening and welcome to the NewsHour. The United States and Iran have come to blows again. American airstrikes hit targets in eastern Syria overnight. The strikes focused on Deir el-Zour and near the towns of Mayadin and Bukamal, aiming at groups linked with Iran's Revolutionary Guard. The Pentagon says it was retaliation after an Iranian-made drone killed a U.S. contractor and wounded six other Americans.
We don't seek escalation with Iran, but the strikes that we took last night were intended to send a very clear message that we will take the protection of our personnel seriously and that we will respond quickly and decisively if they are threatened.
Tonight, Syrian human rights monitors reported new airstrikes after rockets were fired at a base housing American forces. And in Canada, President Biden said the U.S. military will do what's needed to safeguard its 900 troops in northeastern Syria. French President Emmanuel Macron insisted today he won't be deterred from raising the retirement age to 64 despite the worst street violence in years. Trouble erupted overnight after a day of largely peaceful protests. Today, crews in Paris sifted through damage in the wake of street battles between anarchists and police. But Macron vowed to press on.
Face aux violences que je distingue des manifestations.
In the face of violence, which I distinguish from the protests, we continue to be extremely firm. I assure the police of my support, who did an exemplary job. As to everything else, we continue to move forward. The country deserves it and needs it.
The protests today forced Britain's King Charles to postpone a state visit scheduled to start on Sunday. France has also announced it will ban TikTok from government devices, the latest nation to do so. The hugely popular video sharing app is under fire for its ties to China amid rising cybersecurity concerns. The U.S. and other countries have moved toward similar restrictions. The Attorney General of Israel warned today that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is breaking a conflict of interest law. She said he's barred from pushing to overhaul the courts while on trial for corruption. On Thursday, Netanyahu said he's going ahead. In a letter today, the Attorney General said, quote, "Your statement last night and any action you take in violation of this matter is illegal." Paul Rusesa Bagina has been released from custody and will leave Rwanda soon. That's after the government there commuted his sentence. The former hotel manager saved hundreds of people in the 1994 genocide, inspiring the film Hotel Rwanda. But in 2021, he was sentenced to 25 years in prison for terrorism after accusing Rwanda's president of human rights abuses. In Ukraine, a new round of Russian air attacks killed at least 10 civilians today and wounded 20 more. Missiles, exploding drones, and artillery struck sites across southern and eastern Ukraine. Among the targets hit, an aid station where five refugees died. Meanwhile, the UN Human Rights Office issued a report detailing killings and torture of prisoners of war on both sides.
We are deeply concerned about the summary execution of up to 25 Russian prisoners of war and persons ordered to combat by Ukrainian armed forces. We are also deeply concerned by the summary execution of 15 Ukrainian prisoners of war shortly after being captured by Russian armed forces.
The UN documentation could be used in possible trials at the International Criminal Court or other tribunals. Back in this country, Kentucky's Democratic Governor Andy Beshear vetoed a Republican bill focused on transgender children. It would ban gender-affirming care for those under the age of 18 and restrict school bathrooms. The Republican-dominated legislature passed the bill by veto-proof margins and could vote next week on overriding the veto. Public schools in Los Angeles reopened today after a three-day strike by teachers' aides, bus drivers, and others. Up to 30,000 union members walked out this week to demand higher pay, and teachers honored the picket lines. It's unclear if negotiators made any progress during the strike. And on Wall Street, stocks managed small advances despite ongoing worries about the banking industry. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 132 points to close at 32,237. The Nasdaq rose 36 points. The S&P 500 added 22. Still to come on the NewsHour, David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart weigh in on the week's political headlines. A collector of memories reflects on the U.S. invasion of Iraq 20 years later. A husband and wife team in rural Indiana use art to combat consumerism and waste, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
On his first presidential trip to Canada, President Biden met with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and the duo announced a northern border deal to address the growing number of migrants crossing from the U.S. into Canada. In 2022, Canada saw some 40,000 crossings at unofficial points of entry, the highest number in 5 years. Most of those were at Roxham Road in upstate New York, where the crossing into Quebec has become the busiest route for asylum seekers. The deal allows Canada to turn away people at irregular entry points like Roxham and send them back to the United States. Canada also pledged to welcome some 15,000 Central American migrants through legal pathways. President Biden spoke about the deal in a speech to Canada's parliament today.
I applaud Canada for stepping up with similar programs, opening new legal pathways for 1,500 migrants to come to Canada from countries in the Western Hemisphere. At the same time, the United States and Canada will work together to discourage unlawful border crossings and fully implement the updated Safe Third Country Agreement. Welcoming refugees and seeking asylum seekers is a part of who Canadians and Americans are.
Watching all this closely is Abdullah Daoud. He's the executive director of the Refugee Center in Montreal. His group has been working with migrants who've crossed the border into Canada. Abdullah Daoud, welcome and thanks for joining us. Let's start with the impact of that agreement announced today. How big a change is this in terms of how migrants are usually processed and handled when they come into Canada?
I mean, thanks for having me. But it's a big, big change. Like you said, we usually encounter about 40,000 individuals this past year in 2022, and now that we're seeing the number reduced to 15,000, it's kind of scary. These individuals are seeking safety here in Canada and seeking asylum in Canada. They're going to try to come here whichever way they can. So it is a big change and is a very fearful change.
What about the part of the deal in which Canada says they will open up additional legal pathways for some 15,000 people to arrive from, we know, some of those South and Central American countries where we've been seeing a large amount of migration? What do you make of that?
I mean, it's a very small step. Like I said, 15,000 compared to the 40,000 that we just had in this past year. And it's also just from the Western Hemisphere. So if we're looking at the majority of the individuals that come in, there's a lot of individuals who come in from Afghanistan, we're coming from Libya, from Yemen, from West Africa. So it is a diverse mix of individuals who are seeking safety. There's kind of global disorder right now, and a lot of individuals are trying to migrate to safer areas because they are facing persecution. So I don't think it's well thought out. I think it's kind of a knee-jerk reaction to kind of the politicization of the topic lately.
When you talk to these folks, these families that you deal with, you work with there, what do they tell you about why they're deciding to try and come to Canada in particular? What is it that draws them there?
I think Canada does have this reputation that does welcome refugees and it does welcome asylum seekers. And they do believe that they actually have a chance at due process and being heard here. I think that's the most important part. Individuals don't feel that they have that same safety in the United States. So they believe that their best chance to actually seek safety and have their stories heard and provide the actual evidence that they can is in Canada. And this is why they're choosing Canada.
And what about your immigration system? I mean, we've seen here in the United States, the system has been really taxed, pushed to its limits when we've seen the same increase of people arriving at the U.S. southern border. And like many nations, Canada is now seeing a dramatic rise in the number of people seeking asylum there. How has your system been able to handle it?
Just like any system, of course, is a little bit of a strain, but it's nothing that we cannot handle. So, I mean, if you just look at this past year, we accepted over 150,000 Ukrainians as refugees into the country, and our infrastructure was able to accommodate that. So from the about 90 to 92,000 individuals that did claim this past year through all ports of entry, whether irregular or regular, we were able to accommodate that as well. Obviously, with some more investment and some more help, but in general, it's not a number that is unheard of. It is an increase, but we can accommodate it, and we can create obstacles, and we can actually create infrastructures and systems to accommodate more. So this kind of response, I think, is a bit fearful because, you know, just as a lot of historical examples have shown us, when we are restricting migration patterns and we don't create enough of a breathing room for regularized migration patterns, people resort to different means, and bad actors and bad faith actors might come into play, where you can see human smuggling or human trafficking come into play here as well.
You know, U.S. and Canadian officials say they think agreements like this will help to discourage unlawful migration. Do you agree with that?
I don't think so. I think it'd be pretty bad deterrent policy. I think individuals are coming here to seek safety no matter what, by any means necessary. So this is our fear, and this is what the community organizations and human rights advocacy groups have been echoing, is we don't want bad faith actors come in here and take advantage of these people in precarious situations by smuggling them in, allowing more regularized pathways to migration with higher numbers that actually reflect migration patterns is a better solution. So 15,000, while we only had 40,000 this past year, I don't think is a good move forward.
As you know, Mr. Trudeau's government pledged to increase immigration. They welcomed arriving refugees from Syria with open arms, and Canada's always seen as a welcoming place for arriving populations. Do you think that this increase you're seeing now, the politics of this moment, as you referenced, do you think that change, or you'll see that change in Canada in terms of that welcoming spirit?
No, I don't think so. I think that the spirit of the people is very strong. I think everyone here is very welcoming towards refugees. I think there's politicization of this particular topic, and with the wrong policy, people can polarize it. So we're hopeful that the correct policy moves forward and we do increase numbers in a more regularized fashion. And I think that will continue our current welcoming spirit. But I think these increased numbers, again, like I just said, is just a reflection of the sad state of affairs of the world today. So 15,000, I think, is a drop in the bucket. We can definitely do more, and we hope that that there is a current challenge to the Safe Third Country Agreement in court today, and we hope that the challenge goes through.
That is Abdullah Daoud, Executive Director of the Refugee Centre in Montreal. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Today, the U.S. House stepped into the fiery debate about kids and classrooms, passing a bill that Republicans say protects parents' rights in every school district, but opponents call a dangerous move in a culture war. Our Lisa Desjardins reports.
Shame on you!
For years, flaring.
I am so upset that I have to stand before this board,
that is a rising.
That we can't trust that you would actually listen to us. You've obviously got a fully formed opinion.
And sometimes roaring. Debates over schools and kids have now reached the U.S. Capitol.
Should parents have the right to be involved in their child's education? That is the question before us.
But what about the rights of our students? What about the rights of our young people? Why are my Republican colleagues not advocating for our students?
Where House Republicans today passed what they call a priority bill.
The bill is passed.
It is H.R. 5, called the Parents' Bill of Rights. It would require that parents be allowed to see curriculum plans, lists of materials, and can look at any available books. Also, that they will be told about school budgets and any incidents of violence. Republicans say this is simple. It comes out of years of COVID lockdowns and parent sidelining that led to tension and this. A Department of Justice notice in 2021 about threats to teachers and school boards. Some parents felt they were labeled as the threat.
These parents are not to be labeled as domestic terrorists. They are proud parents.
But the debate shows this is also a political and cultural battle with much deeper layers to it.
there is this hostility to traditional values that is seeping into the public schools today.
And in response, deep opposition to this from some parents.
No on HR5!
No on HR5!
These parents from a group called the National Parents Union believe the bill could harm their kids with a chilling effect on what they can read.
We got Minnesota, we got Illinois, we have New Jersey.
They came from across the country to say it misses the real issues in their schools. Jillian Rainingbird is here from Kansas City, Missouri, because she sees increased violence and kids, especially kids of color, failed by schools and resource issues. A mom, including of one child with disabilities, she thinks this bill is a dangerous distraction.
It's devastating to our communities that our kids can't read, but yet and still we want to debate what books are going to be taken out of the curriculum. If the kids can't read, why does it even matter anyway? So let's quit playing with us. Let's start focusing on the real meat and potatoes, and that's about student and family success.
But others disagree, like the mom who sponsored this bill, Representative Julia Letlow, and parents who joined her and Speaker McCarthy at an event last month.
Yes.
Hi. My name is Stacey Womsley. I'm a resident of Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Womsley is a mom who ran and won a seat on her local school board after her own experience left her feeling shut out by school officials.
To have my advocacy for my children characterized as some political ploy was really, it was really hurtful.
Womsley says the Republican bill is also mischaracterized and is not about banning anything.
It doesn't say this book is good, this book is bad. You can say this word, you can't say that word. What it says, what it affirms, is that parents have a right to know what is being taught.
At the Capitol, though,
general debate shall be confined to the bill.
Most controversial has been a part of the bill requiring that teachers notify parents if students are being treated as transgender. Republicans say that addresses parent fears of being in the dark.
Our bill enshrines common sense transparency for parents of children to reflect these concerns.
But Democrats say that is dangerous for kids.
This is about MAGA Republicans who want to start a fake culture war targeting some of the most vulnerable kids in America in our kids' classrooms. Shame on you.
Humanos Unidos!
All of this comes with its own civics lesson about parents with the same ardent motivation, but in completely separate conversations.
This could be a unique opportunity to bring us together, but it could just keep pushing us apart because we are not listening. We hear each other talking, but we're not listening.
House Republicans celebrated the bill's passage today, but it is not expected to move in the Senate.
To talk about what this means for families and in politics is Jennifer Berkshire. She's a journalist who co-hosts the education podcast, Have You Heard?, and is co-author of A Wolf at the Schoolhouse Door about the future of public education. Jen, let's start by let's just take the politicians out for a second. What do we know about where Americans are on this issue of parents and schools?
Well, one thing we know is that the polls have been remarkably consistent over the past couple of years, that parents and Americans across the board, and I am talking about both political parties, which, as you know, is so unusual right now, opposition to anything having to do with book bans and limits on what teachers can teach and kids can learn is broad and deep. And I think people might be really surprised to hear that because you probably think that these laws that keep popping up are, you know, they must be in response to popular demand. And that actually is not the case.
I want to take apart sort of the two sides of this. And first, I want to check in with the parents driving this idea. Is there knowledge that you have? What do we know about the idea that parents in this country are getting blocked out? What is happening there with school systems?
So first of all, I think it's really important to acknowledge just how awful the pandemic was for everyone, but for parents in particular. And so I think it would be a big mistake for us to just write off this movement as AstroTurf or, you know, the product just of politicians who want to stir the pot in order to reap political gold. You know, there is definitely something going on, but it's also the case that the longer we see this movement, as we watch it evolve, the causes keep morphing and the demands get more and more extreme. And so whereas there was initially quite a lot of support for things like, say, reopening schools or greater parent involvement in schools, now more and more as we see those demands start to translate into things like banning particular books or focusing so much attention on trans kids in particular, you see public opinion in favor of that movement diminish.
And that's what I want to ask about, because this bill that was passed in the House, we don't think it's going to go much farther, but this bill doesn't have a book ban in it. But the opponents say that this is part of conservatives, especially using the phrase parental rights, to push opposition and even shut out some things that those parents oppose, like books. What do you make of that? Is this sort of a behind-the-scenes push? Are these things connected, or is there no connection?
I thought it was really interesting that you heard so many Republican leaders get really defensive about precisely that question. And that's because they know that for more and more Americans, the parents' rights cause is getting harder and harder to distinguish from these unpopular book bans. And one thing that we should really remember is that there were a lot of politicians who ran on the parents' rights cause during the midterms, and they did not do well. Where you saw, you know, we saw Republicans win when they were up for re-election, when they were reaching out to the base. But as far as an issue that galvanized suburban women in particular, the parents' rights cause was a failure. And I think you hear that in these concerns of leaders on Capitol Hill who are worried that what they thought was going to be this cause that lured independence or suburban women is now coming to be seen as something actually extreme and unpopular.
I noticed something when I was reporting this story that I wasn't looking for, but was hard to ignore. If you look at these photos, the one on the left is a photo of Speaker McCarthy and the supporters of this parents' rights bill. Now, on the right, you see the opponents and the picture I took with them yesterday. There's a clear difference between these two groups. On the left, you see the supporters, mostly white, appear to be white families. On the right, you see those who appear to be almost entirely people of color. It made me wonder, what is the role in race here? Is there one?
Absolutely, there's a role. So many of the earliest iterations of these bills limiting what teachers can teach and kids can learn were focused on race. And I think that those, you know, that picture you just showed is so striking. And that part of the reason that we're seeing the popularity of the cause drop is precisely that, precisely because of that I could point you to one state after another where some kind of restrictive law has been passed, and there is a version of the picture on the left that looks exactly like that. Why is it always, you know, why are the kids always white? What is going on? And I think there is a strong element of race playing into this that people are definitely picking up on.
One last quick question. Is this issue a fad, or is this an issue that you think will be here a long time?
Actually, this is not the first time we've seen parents' rights emerge as an issue. And when it came up in the 90s, one of the reasons that it lost support and withered away was precisely what we're seeing now. The more people get a clear sense that something that sounds good in the abstract, giving parents more say, too easily translates into banning particular books or limiting what kids in a whole school have access to, the less they like it.
Jennifer Berkshire, a conversation I know so many of our viewers are interested in and we will continue to have. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Healthcare systems and hospitals across the country are grappling with a nationwide shortage of the asthma medication albuterol. Stephanie Tsai looks at who's affected and what's being done about it.
Liquid albuterol is commonly used in emergency departments as a quick relief breathing treatment for several chronic lung diseases, such as asthma, COPD, COVID-19, RSV, and pneumonia. It's been on the FDA's short supply list since October. And last month, Acorn Pharmaceuticals, the primary U.S. manufacturer of liquid albuterol, filed for bankruptcy and closed operations. We spoke to two people who are already feeling the impact.
I'm Angela Folger. I am the director of pharmacy at Nemours Children's Hospital in Florida. This shortage has been significant. Obviously, working in a pediatric hospital, we use quite a bit of albuterol. We have quite a few asthma patients.
I'm Samantha Eddins. I live in Lincoln, Nebraska. I'm a mom of three, and two are on vents. They were born at 24 weeks gestation via C-section. They get four treatments a day between the two of them. So they get one in the morning and one at night before bed. It's an albuterol sulfate concentration, and we just do it through like a nebulizer machine. But they have special attachments that they can attach it to their ventilator circuit to make the ventilator push it into their lungs.
We have switched almost all of our patients to the more dilute product, which is still effective, still works well. But on the pharmacy side of that, it created some challenges for our patients that require a continuous albuterol treatment. So our most sick asthmatic patients that require that.
Last month, they only gave me a month's supply. So between the time that I had used their last one to the time that they ordered the new one to get into the pharmacy, I had to dip into my personal stash to give them their meds. So just so that they can do that overlap between I don't have any to I have some. They get it twice a day and we go through it twice as fast as a normal typical family would.
We are seeing an increase in flu. We are having still some COVID patients. We are seeing a significant increase in RSV, and all of those patients require albuterol. I think we really need additional manufacturers to step up and start adding this to their portfolio so that we're not reliant on a single source for the medication that we need for our patients.
The FDA says they are working closely with manufacturers to address the shortage. Dr. Juanita Mora is an allergist and immunologist in Chicago and national spokesperson for the American Lung Association. Dr. Mora, thank you for joining us. As you just heard, albuterol is used commonly to treat very young children because they can't use those inhalers. Are you concerned about how this shortage of liquid albuterol is affecting that age group in particular?
Very concerned, because we're talking about 25 million asthmatics in the United States, 20 million COPDers. You add the long haul COVID, and we just came out of a brutal respiratory viral season where we used albuterol tons, which was with COVID, RSV, and flu. And now we're heading into allergic asthma season as well, too, where we're going to see a lot of kids, a lot of adults impacted and needing this life-saving drug because it's used to help open up the lungs when all these kids and all these adults aren't able to breathe. And this is why it's such an important topic for us to be talking about today.
Yeah, and we heard that parent saying that she's basically rationing her albuterol at home, that she's giving her kids some of her albuterol. The other expert saying that they're having to dilute albuterol. Is that what you are advising your patients to do?
Well, at this time, unfortunately, because of all the albuterol is being sent to the hospitals and emergency departments and urgent cares, then clinics and then parents at home or anyone who use liquid albuterol is not able to get it. So we are advising if they have any to possibly actually do dilute some dilutions, but it's not the best actual option. We want someone to really step up and help in this albuterol shortage, especially as we're heading now into spring allergy season. And tons of asthmatics are triggered by allergies at this time. And we are going to end up using a lot of the actual reserve that we have for liquid albuterol. And this is very concerning as we're already in shortage.
Are there alternatives, especially for the younger children who need to use liquid albuterol with a nebulizer?
Well, currently what we have are actual solutions called Sopinus, which is levalbuterol, and Duoneb as well, too. The problem is the companies haven't produced them in mass quantities, and also their costs. So it's hard for actual insurances to cover it and for parents to be able to afford it. So that's the problem that we're currently running into.
So besides the very young and, as you say, the elderly who are not able to use albuterol inhalers, it sounds like you're also saying that people that are particularly economically vulnerable that might not have private insurance are at risk here.
Definitely. That is a population I'm concerned with, especially because they were the hardest hit communities when it came to COVID-19.
What do you see as the solution to this shortage?
Well, I'm hoping that the FDA will continue to encourage pharmaceuticals to really pitch in. If COVID-19 has taught us anything, is that we have to take care of each other. And I felt pharmaceuticals really stepped up to help. And I'm hoping they will as well with this albuterol shortage, which is so important. And so that we don't have to outsource to other countries for help to meet the needs of all these asthmatics, COPDers, and every child and adult with a respiratory illness who currently needs this medication as a life-saving treatment.
Now, from what I understand, there is only one U.S. manufacturer of albuterol right now in operation for a very common drug. Dr. Juanita Mora with the American Lung Association, thanks for joining the NewsHour.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for having me. And people can learn more at lung.org.
To delve further into the latest in former President Trump's legal woes, the debate over parents' influence in schools, and the future of TikTok in the U.S., we turn now to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That is New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post. And welcome to you both. It's good to see you. Jonathan, I want to start with you and pick up where Lisa's report left off. This whole issue of parental rights, it has come to mean so much. And I just want to start with some definitions. So let's just talk about this debate and where it is right now and what that phrase, parental rights, means to you, how you look at this issue.
Well, to me, when I hear parental rights, I keep thinking, what happened to the PTA? Parent teachers associations. Why all of a sudden is this an issue? And I think it's an issue given who they're targeting because they need a foil. The far right needs a foil. That's not to say that parents don't have concerns about what their kids are learning in classrooms. It just seems like from, you know, Governor Ron DeSantis in Florida to Governor Huckabee in Arkansas to the, you know, the Republican-led House of Representatives, it seems like they have a problem specifically with trans kids. And what I have a problem with is that the party of life, the party of respect for family and individual freedom has no problem putting a target on the backs of trans kids and their families. And so when I hear parental rights, I think parental rights for whom?
David, what do you think about that?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of crazy stuff going on in the schools, a lot of the book banning and stuff like that, the not teaching Black history and things like that. So I want to bracket that aside and say that stuff is outrageous. Nonetheless, there is a core problem here, is that during COVID, a lot of parents got a look at what their kids were doing because the classroom turned into the living room. And they didn't like a lot of what they saw. And so public school enrollment is down by $1.4 million. 60-odd percent of parents say they want more control over their kids' learning. It used to be Democrats had a solid advantage, and who do you trust in schools? That advantage is gone. And so there's been some sort of seismic shift on a lot of parents who are disillusioned. Most are fine with the school. Most hate it when politics gets put in the school. Mm. But there is a sense there's something that they want more control over. And so that's the legit part of this. And I think what the core problem here, a reference to this bill, is parents and teachers have to be in cooperation, and there has to be trust. And I understand the cost, but if a school is keeping important things about their kids secret from the parents, that's going to destroy trust, and you're going to get the reaction we've seen.
Can I just go back to the thing you wanted to bracket out, all those other issues?
Yeah.
But they are bracketed in. They are under the umbrella of this issue.
No, and so I'm saying that, I mean, you've got to go parent by parent, case by case.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of clearly wedge issue stuff going on here. But there's also a lot of parents who legitimately think the values of my school are different than my values. I just want some representation here, or I want some say in how my kids are being taught, and they don't feel they're getting it. So you can have, it's a bunch of different issues all at once, I would say.
There is, when you take a broader look, Jonathan, to your point, this is all happening against the backdrop of a number of Republican state legislatures nationwide proposing and pushing through bills that do center on transgender youth, right? This is a map just out this week from the Human Rights Campaign. They now estimate of all the transgender kids across the country, aged 13 to 17, just that age group, more than half of them now live in a state where they have either already lost access to or could lose access to gender-affirming care. It's over 50% now. And Jonathan, I want to turn to you on this because that's a striking number, first of all, when you think of the sheer volume of children who are impacted by that. But I'm wondering why you think this particular issue resonates so deeply right now.
Because it makes people feel uncomfortable. Let's just be perfectly frank about it. It makes people uncomfortable. But just because you're uncomfortable doesn't mean that you then target what makes you uncomfortable. And by target, you're targeting kids. You're targeting the families of those kids, making it impossible for them to get health care in their own home state, making it almost impossible for them to go out of state, criminalizing, in some cases, going out of state to get care. All these kids and their families want are for these trans kids to be able to go to school like everyone else, learn like everyone else, and be left alone like everyone else, if possible. And to be able to learn in a classroom environment where there's neither a target on their back or they're not being denied the full history, the full curriculum that they're supposed to be taught. The problem I have with what's been happening in the states, and particularly with this congressional bill, is that the language is so vague. In that report, the person said, you know, it doesn't specify names of books and things. Well, no, it leaves it up to the discretion of whoever the person is complaining. And so I think what needs to happen is that people need to, those really concerned parents, not only do they need to keep rising up, they need allies to rise up with them, to add to their numbers, because there are more people who care about those children and care about their education than the rabble-rousing parents who are putting the targets on their backs.
Yeah, I mean, it's insane that we're having the education debate we're having right now. And so if you look at what happened, if you look at New York City schools, 41% of kids were chronically truant. If you look at what's happened across American schools over the last few years, we spent 20 years doing education reform, trying to lift scores. All those gains were erased through COVID and over the last year or two. That's going to alter the lives, the GDP of this country for decades. And so we're in the middle of an education, I don't want to say catastrophe, but a real setback in the way our kids are doing. And we're talking about this, the transgender stuff. Like, what?
But that's where Republicans are choosing
to
focus, right?
Exactly right. Yeah. And so, I sometimes think that the parents, you know, this issue didn't surprise Republicans. When Glenn Youngkin ran for governor of Virginia, he didn't think he was going to run on schools, but so many parents were coming to him, he ran on schools and he ended up winning. Yeah. But it is still insane that this is what we're talking about if we're going to talk about schools.
I'm clearly going to be talking about it for many weeks and months to come. I do want to turn to news out of the Manhattan District Attorney's office this week, though, because just today, we know Alvin Bragg, in the way of background, has been probing the hush money payment made to a woman who said she was having an affair with former President Trump. Just today, NBC was reporting that Bragg received a death threat in the mail to his office that contained a white powder. The DA's office had a statement issued that said it was not dangerous, but this does come on the heels of Mr. Trump and Republicans ramping up their attacks on Alvin Bragg. Jonathan, we do not know if this letter and those attacks or the verbal attacks in any way are connected, but it is a really disturbing development.
It is a disturbing development. No, we don't know that there is a direct connection, but let's face it. At 1:08 this morning, the former president of the United States sent out a raging social media post filled with threats of violence and invective against the Manhattan DA, one of many that he's done all week. There's no, we can't draw a line between the two, a direct line, but you can't separate the two. What the former president is doing is outrageous. The fact that Republicans won't roundly criticize him for doing so and condemning what he's doing and standing up for the rule of law is outrageous. And I think we all need to take the Donald Trump's statements about the Manhattan DA and other DAs who are investigating him. We have to take it seriously. He called for action in January 6th, and we saw what happened. We cannot afford to let that happen again.
David, that Truth Social post we put up had Mr. Trump saying there could be potential death and destruction if he was indicted on these charges. And today, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said he's worried that Mr. Trump is going to get someone killed. Are you worried about that?
Absolutely. I mean, I thought I was beyond the ability to be shocked by Donald Trump. But when I woke up this morning and read that, the only word that leapt to mind was barbaric and definitely insightful. If anything was insightful, what he's done is insightful. And so it's just shocking. It should also be said that there's reason he's doing it, which is that 2-3 weeks ago, he had maybe a 10-point advantage on Ron DeSantis. And now if you look at some of the averages of the polls, it's up to 25 points. And some of that is DeSantis going down, but Trump is going up. And so this whole indictment talk is helping Trump politically.
I want to ask you as well about the TikTok hearing on Capitol Hill. I know you were following it all, and there has been a concerted effort. There were a number of, actually, hearings on the House side that same day focused on China. How did you look at those, David?
Yeah, we're in the middle of a Cold War with China. It started. And this has happened over two administrations, but especially with the Biden administration. It's now official U.S. policy. And I support it. I'm just saying how stark and dramatic we should take it. Official U.S. policy to ban the chips and the technology used to make the chips that could go into a phone, a car, a toaster, or a missile, or a drone, or AI technology. So we are now really trying to crack down on not just the Chinese military, but the Chinese economy. Because there's really no difference between these two things. So that is just a very stark thing. Mm-hmm. So if you're wondering, were we in a Cold War? Well, we were against the Soviets. We're now behaving like we are against China, and I think we are with the Chinese, and it tends to hit technology most. TikTok, G5, chips, green energy, that's the battlefield in this Cold War. Who controls the technology?
Jonathan, we've got about 30 seconds left. Do you see it the same way? We're in a Cold War with China now?
Well, when David puts it like that, yes, how could I argue? Also because of what we've seen, what China has done on the diplomatic front in the last few weeks, the deal that China brokered between, I think it was Saudi Arabia and Iran, huge deal. I'm old enough to remember when the United States used to seek deals like that. Now it's the Chinese.
Jonathan Capehart, David Brooks, always good to see you both. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Anna.
This week marks 20 years since the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and many are still piecing together what happened in those days and the years that followed. NewsHour digital senior editor Yasmin Alamiri spoke to Sena Morani of the University of Plymouth in England about Ruptured Domesticity, a project that collects the memories and artifacts of Iraqis during the war and how they held on to the concept of home.
You headed up a multi-part project. Part of which is archiving these memories of the war for Iraqis who were living inside and outside the country during that time. Can you talk to us a little bit about why you decided to pursue this project and what came of it?
Something that I really wanted to understand is what was happening across the country when Baghdad was getting bombarded during the 2003 invasion. I had no idea. We were in Baghdad, but I did not know what was going on in Mosul, what was going on in Basra, what was going on elsewhere. So the archive idea came because I really wanted the world to see this. I wanted it to be the collective voice of Iraqis.
War is traumatic for everybody involved. And when you have years, decades of war, what you end up with is generational trauma. I wonder about how that enduring trauma has impacted the way that Iraqis interact with the country, but also their memory or their understanding of what it means to be Iraqi.
Through the conversations that I've had with Iraqis from the north to the south of Iraq, they kept on coming back to this thing of, we never documented what was going on to us at the time. We don't have records, especially during the 2003 invasion, when mobile phones and cameras, digital cameras, weren't readily available for people. So there was this thing of trauma that lingers, trauma that is carried with you, and it resurfaces in very different ways. It sometimes resurfaces in PTSD, which we've seen it, you know, across the world happening with people engaged in wars in Iraq and elsewhere, but also in collective creative outlet of that, where you see a burst of cultural belongings and tendency to want to make change happen.
As an Iraqi who has lived outside of the country as well, what does it mean to you to be Iraqi?
It changes. So I kind of remember when I first came out of Iraq, when people used to ask me the question, my answer was very different to what it is right now. I find it in the connections to the beautiful music, to the wonderful food that we have, to the language that is spoken from the gut with passion, to the kind of the Iraqi humor that is retrieved and found and kind of emerges in your face in the darkest of times. I see myself an Iraqi right in the center of all of that. So it is a tapestry. But I kind of feel that this is always going to be in the making. It's never going to have a form or an end to its making. And I love that about it. But there is certainly a yearning for a home that I kind of, it's always going to be there and it's never going to fade for me.
And that was just part of Yasmin's conversation with Sana Mourani. You can watch the full version and see more from Mourani's project online at pbs.org/newshour. And creating art and raising awareness about consumerism at the same time. Special correspondent Kat Wise visited a husband and wife team in rural Indiana to see how they've pivoted their lives and their livelihoods to focus on this passion. It's part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Down a quiet country road near Spencerville, Indiana, you'll come across a farm that doesn't look like others in the area. A different kind of product is cultivated here, art.
Let's go to the studio.
Man, it's cold out.
The colorful home and studio of Lisa Vetter and Paul Seifert and their dog Pinkerton is known as the Art Farm. The married couple, who grew up in nearby Fort Wayne, have turned their farm into an artistic oasis where they create and display their work, clocks, sculptures, jewelry, and more. All made out of found objects they started collecting about 30 years ago.
We both loved going to flea markets and junk shops and finding cool stuff.
Vintage stuff.
Vintage stuff. I swear, I said one time, you know, we got to stop buying all this cool stuff or we got to start doing something with it all.
Yeah.
So then we started manipulating it. Mm-hmm.
Paul, who has a background in engineering, and Lisa, who worked in interior design, began making functional pieces like lamps, which they started selling at art shows in the mid-1990s. Soon, the part-time hobby became a full-time job.
I want to finish working on this pendant that I started here.
Today, Paul and Lisa create new life for old objects in their workshop on the farm, where anything can become art.
Tell me about a piece like this. This is a work in progress, is that right?
For example, if I'm at the thrift store and I see this sitting on the shelf, I'm like, oh yeah, that's a skirt. But we've got a lot of old, you know, the old coffee tins and stuff. Look how perfectly that fits.
That's a big deal when something fits perfectly.
The connection.
Things gotta fit or they get wobbly. You wanna make art so that it lasts. I want somebody to give it down to their kids and hopefully their kids, so I just don't want to make art that's just going to be a throwaway.
Preventing things from being thrown away is a big focus of Paul and Lisa's work.
It drives me nuts to see the amount of poor quality, useless stuff being peddled to people, and it has a very short shelf life, and then it's just thrown away. It's going into a landfill. Maybe instead of going to Target and buying a new clock, you buy a clock that I made out of old recycled items that no one else will have one like it.
Paul and Lisa take their clocks and other work, with a price range from under $100 to around $1,000, to juried art fairs around the country, where artists are selected through a competitive application process. Art shows have provided a significant portion of their annual sales, but since the pandemic, they've been focusing more on commissions, like a recent one that involved a cello, and pop-up galleries at the farm.
Is it difficult to make a living this way?
If you are not interested in a steady paycheck, it's okay, because you never know. People will ask us that sometimes, you know, do you make a living at this? And I tell people, we make a life. It's the whole package, you know? We're self-employed, we steer the ship.
And I don't know if I'm living in a fancy world, but it does feel like our whole life, our art and our garden and how we live, it's all the same thing. The art's not separated from the way we live.
How big is your property?
We have 5 acres total.
So during our recent visit, they took me on a tour of their property, including the 160-year-old barn where they store the rig they use when they travel to art fairs.
She runs good. Her name is Agnes.
And when we roll into the show, people know that we're there because no one else is driving in 1977.
Yeah.
Midas Mini Home.
And I've learned to put cheap beers in my fridge to give to all my artist friends that ask me for a cold beer. Because when you have a rig, your beer's always cold.
Yep.
So you go with the cheap beer.
Oh, yeah. Not the expensive one.
No.
Many of the artists Paul and Lisa have met at shows over the years have become friends, whose art is displayed, along with their own, throughout their restored 1860s farmhouse.
This is a sculpture piece from our friend Ed, who did the mugs that we're using this morning. And this is an artist from Indianapolis. She created this. It's me and Paul. And the little banner, the unforeseen glory of art farming. We were over the moon. We didn't know she was doing this.
You love this piece.
Oh, this I love this piece. It's so fun.
Paul and Lisa are trying to spread awareness about consumerism and waste in their community by hosting school groups and art classes that focus on reused materials.
I like the fact that they use found objects and make them live again.
Oh, now these are new.
Sandy Beaver, who lives nearby, is a regular at the art farm and stopped by on a recent evening to check out some of Lisa's new jewelry.
The blue metal in the background is actually building material metal. And then this is recycled license plate.
That's what I like about Lisa's artwork. I know her, I know her quirkiness, and I enjoy that. I want something that means something to me, and her artwork does.
Lisa, I think this piece needs to be green, right?
Paul and Lisa are spending long hours in the workshop these days, creating more art and gearing up for a busy spring and summer on the farm. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Kat Wise in Spencerville, Indiana.
Love that line, the difference between making a living and making a life. Hey, listen, later tonight, be sure to tune in to Washington Week, guest hosted by our very own Laura Barone Lopez, right here on PBS, for more analysis of former President Trump's mounting legal challenges. And watch PBS News Weekend with John Yang tomorrow for a look at the barriers stopping people from getting basic medical care. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us and have a great weekend.